This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The Democratic Republic of Congo is struggling to deal with an influx of suspected South Sudanese rebels. The Congolese army has arrested at least 9 men so far, but family members and local refugee leaders say the men are legitimate refugees and should be released.
That's Jason Patinkin reporting from the Congolese border town of Aba. Details coming up also. The United States Africa Command says an airstrike in Somalia has killed at least 13 suspected al-Shabaab militants. Liberian voters are waiting for the results of yesterday's runoff for president. And Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa has named the army chief who helped put him in office to be one of his vice presidents. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the United States Africa Command says an airstrike in Somalia has killed at least 13 suspected al-Shabaab militants. The command said today the strike was carried out on Sunday in cooperation with Somalia security forces and the AMISOM African Union Force. It did not say where it occurred or how many aircrafts were involved in the attack. The U.S. has stepped up its strikes against the al-Shabaab Islamic militants in the past few months. Early in December, the U.S. military said it killed 8 militants in an airstrike and reported that it had killed as many as 100 in a late November attack. Liberian voters are waiting for the results of yesterday's runoff for president. It pits Senator and former sports star George Weah against Vice President Joseph Boakai. Reuters says the National Elections Commission has asked both candidates and media not to declare victory ahead of a formal announcement of results later today. VOA's James Butty is in Monrovia. He spoke about the wait for results with reporter William Eagle in Washington.
The National Elections Commission correlates the results from the fields, from the different provinces. The elections is conducting a tally process under the watchful eye of the representatives from the two political parties that were in the runoff election. Also, the process is open to the general public. We were told by the Elections Commission officials that the commission will hold a news conference sometime today. We do not know whether that is going to be today, but it's still time before the day is over. So they are supposed to have a news conference to give what probably will be their first preliminary official results from Tuesday's runoff election.
Also, have there been any commentary or word from international observers on how the elections went in their view?
A moment ago, a joint news conference by the Economic Community of West Africa's Observer Mission, as well as the African Union Observer Mission, concluded. The African Union Observer Mission is led by Mr. Erastus Mwecha, who is the deputy chair of the African Union Commission. And the ECOWAS delegation is led by former president of Ghana, Mr. John Mahama. Mwecha of the African Union said that based on what they are told by their observers, that the process, the electoral process on Tuesday, was held in a peaceful and transparent manner, that all the polling places were open on time and peaceful. The voting process was done in a secret way as it's supposed to be. Polling centers, he said, their observers tell them that the polling centers were accessible. All voters, they say they talked to who came to vote on Tuesday, told them that they were satisfied with the process. So, and the way the process opened and closed was also done properly, that they did not notice anyone complaining about the way the process went. The West African Community ECOWAS, Mr. John Mahama, also reported that both the African Union and the ECOWAS are meeting with the two representatives of the two parties, George Weah and Vice President Joseph Boakai, that they impressed upon the two candidates to exercise restraint. In case the results come out, they must try to exercise restraint, because the way they behave will determine how their supporters will behave. The candidates assure them, he said, Mr. Mahama said, they will support whatever results come out, provided that those results are fair and free. The ECOWAS delegation believes that the election was conducted in a free, fair, and transparent manner.
That's VOA's James Bhatti in Monrovia. He was speaking with reporter William Eagle. The Democratic Republic of Congo is struggling to deal with an influx of suspected South Sudanese rebels. The Congolese army has arrested at least 9 men so far, but family members and local refugee leaders say the men are legitimate refugees and should be released. Jason Patinkin reports from the Congolese border town of Aba.
Since South Sudan's government captured a rebel base last week in the country's southwest, hundreds of refugees have poured into Democratic Republic of Congo. Some among them may be rebels, and the Congolese army, wary of conflict spilling into their nation, is arresting any suspected fighters. Refugees say innocent young men are being caught up in the crackdown. Grace Gaba, speaking from the border town of Aba, where some 30,000 refugees have taken shelter, says her brother, Joseph Moreau, was arrested by Congolese troops at a checkpoint last week and has been held ever since. She says, among us 8, only my brother was arrested. Maybe they think my brother is a soldier, but he is not a soldier. It is hard to say how many suspected rebels have been arrested so far. A Congolese government source not authorized to speak to media said 9 suspected rebels were in army custody as of last week. Local refugee leaders put the number at 17. Alexi Kabambi, who leads Congo's National Commission for Refugees in Aba, says those determined to be rebels are sent to a military base in the town of Dungu, where they may be extradited to South Sudan. Kabambi says even if rebels enter Congo unarmed and renounce their military allegiances, they cannot be granted refugee status. He says, once you've carried a weapon, you cannot be accorded refugee status as a civilian. Even if you're granted refugee status, if it is revealed you engaged in military activities in the past, your status can be revoked. Liwa Morris Taban, chairman of ABBA's South Sudanese refugee community, says anyone who enters Congo as a civilian should be allowed to register as a refugee, even if that person was previously a combatant.
If he's no more rebel or he's not even a soldier, he's a normal civilian, he has the right to be together with the rest in the side.
Researcher Alan Boswell says South Sudanese government soldiers who enter Congo can usually be sent home. But dealing with rebel fighters who cross the border is trickier.
Some want to be demobilized and be settled as refugees, but others will later want to return back and fight. It is essentially not possible to distinguish between who is ready to quit fighting and who is only there to recoup, recover, and return to combat.
As South Sudan's war continues, Congo will continue to struggle with combatants on both sides of the border. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Aba, Democratic Republic of Congo.
UN officials were hoping that the new year would bring Libya's factions around to a peaceful accord. But yesterday, an explosion hit the Sidra pipeline, 256 kilometers southeast of the coastal city. The line was hit by 2 IEDs, likely by extremist groups. The attackers successfully fled into the desert. Local media outlets say that Libyan oil production may drop anywhere between 70,000 to 100,000 barrels. Jason Pack is the executive director of the U.S.-Libyan Business Association. He explained to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi how this attack could impact the situation in Libya.
This attack on a pipeline feeding from various Waha fields to the Sidra terminal will take between 50 and 100,000 barrels out of production. Maybe, though, within a few short days or weeks, this bit of pipeline can be repaired. As always, with any negative, there could be a potential silver lining, which is if the different actors, international and in Libya, the General National Accord government, the Libyan National Army, the National Oil Corporation, can all work together and confront this crisis to repair the pipeline, they could find a new way of working together to increase production, help Libya's economy and the humanitarian situation.
UN envoy to Libya, Hassan Salama, is optimistic that most probably Libya will become closer to a solution in 2018, citing a number of steps, including All Libyans Conference, the elections, and the adoption of a certain constitution. Is there any room or basis for such optimism?
Well, the UN envoy, Hassan Salama, has been doing a great job. He's working energetically to bring the sides and factions together. And there is a room for optimism that the UN process is reinvigorated. For example, President Trump hosted the Libyan Government of National Accord Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj here in Washington on December 1st. That was a major step that signals that the different international actors are on the same page. Inside Libya, there are also talks to unify the army between various Misratin factions, Zintani factions, and of course, General Khalifa Haftar in the east. So it's not a great situation at present, but there are some kernels of hope that political breakthroughs might happen in 2018.
Salama says also he has an action plan that includes trying to produce a government that would provide a safety net during the months that separate Libya from the phase of stability. This phase might last for a maximum of 1 year. With the current situation of three major rivals, is it feasible to have a unity government?
I think that's a little bit more difficult. Salama's plan is to have elections by the end of 2018, and many of the major players, like the Prime Minister I just mentioned, Sarraj, as well as General Haftar, are positioning themselves for the elections and trying to at least outwardly embrace the UN process. This is something that can be capitalized on, and maybe with buy-in, each side thinks he will win the elections, and those elections can happen. It doesn't mean that in the interim, though, any kind of unity government can be put into place, because these rivals all want to benefit from the current instability and benefit from the UN plan to come out on top.
Some regional and Western countries support certain Libyan military and political parties out of their belief that these parties can protect their interests in Libya. How would this impact the UN action plan?
Of course, the problem has always been since 2014, when Libya split into two rival factions or governments, that different regional and international actors support one or the other. And what's needed, of course, is to get all of the international community on the same page so that the Libyans know they can't play off one faction against another. I do believe that there's been progress on this accord and progress in getting the Egyptians and the Emiratis and the U.S. and France and Italy all on the same page. And that has to do with the good actions of the U.N. envoy and different regional players and Western leaders like Macron in hosting meetings and Trump in meeting with the Libyan prime minister. And hopefully these meetings gain momentum so that the Libyan factions know the only way forward is working with the UN plan.
That was Jack Pack of the U.S. Libyan Business Association. He was speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. You are listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
The National Elections Commission correlates the results.
18 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. The United States Africa Command says an airstrike in Somalia has killed at least 13 suspected Al-Shabaab militants. Liberian voters are waiting for the results of yesterday's runoff election for president. And the Democratic Republic of Congo is struggling to deal with an influx of suspected South Sudanese rebels. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa has named the army chief who helped put him in office to be one of his vice presidents. State media say retired General Constantino Chiwenga will be sworn in Thursday. Former State Security Minister Kembo Mohadi will be sworn in as the other vice president. Chiwenga led the military operation last month that eventually led to the resignation of President Robert Mugabe, who led the nation for 37 years. 7 years. Earlier this week, Mnangagwa named Mohadi and Chiwenga to be the vice presidents of the ruling ZANU-PF party. Their appointment to become vice presidents, however, were delayed because those appointments must be confirmed by the acting secretary of the cabinet. U.S. President Donald Trump campaigned as a booster of fossil fuels and a skeptic of climate change science, and his policies over the past year have reflected these views. VOA Steve Barragona has a look at 2017 in climate and energy policy under the Trump administration.
Some of the first strokes of Donald Trump's presidential pen revived two oil pipelines President Obama had canceled.
Keystone Pipeline.
It was an opening move in a new doctrine of energy dominance that Trump says protects national security.
For over 40 years, America was vulnerable to foreign regimes that used energy as an economic weapon.
But new technology has transformed the United States from a major energy importer to a major exporter. And President Trump aims to take full advantage. He moved to open public lands to coal, oil, and natural gas exploration, to loosen regulations on energy production, and to scrap rules aimed at fighting climate change. That included undoing President Obama's rules on greenhouse gas emissions from power plants.
Perhaps no single regulation threatens our miners, energy workers, and companies more than this crushing attack on American industry.
Yet critics note that most states are on track to meet the regulation's goals without crushing their industries. And they question Trump's reasons for withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord.
This agreement is less about the climate and more about other countries gaining a financial advantage over the United States.
Meanwhile, 2017 looks to be in the top three warmest years on record. Scientists increasingly see evidence of climate change in heat waves, storms, and other extreme weather. Critics say Trump's efforts are going in the wrong direction. Nicholas Bianco at the World Resources Institute notes that many of the administration's rollbacks are being challenged in court.
Now, they haven't succeeded yet, and we can expect over the next year to see pushback.
Pushback from cities, states, and businesses, for instance. Former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg co-chairs a group of them, representing roughly half the U.S. economy, who have pledged that the U.S. will meet its greenhouse gas targets in spite of Trump.
Americans don't need Washington to meet our Paris commitment, and Americans are not going to let Washington stand in the way of fulfilling it.
And cutting emissions is getting cheaper as the cost of wind and solar power continue to plummet. Renewables now challenge fossil fuels in some areas of the country. But the Trump administration has proposed changing the rules in electric markets to favor coal. And Environmental Protection Agency Chief Scott Pruitt is planning a debate on climate science itself.
I believe the ability to measure with precision the degree of human activity's impact on the climate is subject to more debate.
But the world's leading scientific societies have concluded that human activity is the leading cause of climate change. Pruitt's views contradict them, Bianco notes.
Which is a very sobering thought for an agency, an EPA, that's tasked with protecting public health.
The year ends with wildfires raging across California and more predicted with climate change, and battles over climate policy continuing to rage across the country. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
An extraordinary rebreeding project in South Africa has successfully brought an animal back from extinction. The quagga, a subspecies of zebra, is now thriving in the country after being wiped out by hunters about 150 years ago. Now there are plans to create so-called super herds of the unique creatures and for them to roam their original habitat. Darren Taylor reports.
Conservationist March Turnbull says the quagga is a colour variant of the common zebra.
At its simplest, that means it's got a lot less stripes and it's got a lot more brown than your normal plain zebra. So what you do is you go and get animals which are a bit less stripy and a bit more brown, and you start breeding them together.
Turnbull's the coordinator of the Quagga Project It wants to re-establish the animals in their original territory of the dry Karoo region of central South Africa. In the 19th century, the quagga were hunted for their hides and eventually exterminated.
In the Karoo, where there is very little grazing anyway, the farmers just didn't want anybody competing with their sheep and their goat and their cows and what have you, so they just got rid of them.
Turnbull explains that the project began 30 years ago with 19 captured zebra that looked quagga-like. There are now 143 such animals spread over 11 private ranches in the Western Cape province.
Of those 143 animals, 9, I think, at the moment, would probably be able to blend into a quagga herd of the 19th century, and the rest are all quite distinctly quagga-like, i.e. they don't look like normal stripy zebras.
Turnbull says 25 of the animals have been selected to form 2 core herds to breed the purest forms of quagga possible. Critics of the project have labelled it an unethical freak show. Turnbull says this criticism is because of the hunting industry, which is breeding colour variants of animals like the springbok antelope for people to shoot for large profits.
If you put enough black springboks in a camp together, you end up with a whole heap of black springboks. That is mutations, and that is breeding mutations, mutations which almost certainly wouldn't survive as a big population in the wild. We are not mutating. We're just taking natural variations and concentrating them.
Other critics say just because the project's animals look like quagga doesn't mean they're indeed quagga.
It is possible that they were distinguished as quaggas not only by how they looked. It's just possible that they made a slightly different noise, or that they were very odd in that they fought in a particular way when the stallions were fighting. We don't know that because we don't have those accurate observations. Theoretically, it is possible that as all those quaggas were shot out, some particularly strong brown hide gene was lost forever. We don't think so.
But given scientific findings, including DNA analysis, that the quagga is simply a subspecies of the plain zebra, it seems safe to say that the only factor that makes a quagga is the coloration of its hide. Turnbull says the quest to restore quaggas to their natural state in South Africa is important to the country's environmental heritage.
It's not making money. It's an effort, more than anything, to undo a wrong that has happened in the past, because there's no reason for them to not exist anymore. And if we can bring them back, why wouldn't we?
There are other similar initiatives involving previously extinct species, like the European bison and wild horses in Central Asia. But Turnbull says the quagga project's unique.
There are certainly no rebreeding projects of this sort which have been so carefully and well documented over 30 years. Every animal, we know the mother, the father, and their genealogy down 5 generations. It's probably the most scientifically done project in the world.
Turnbull and his colleagues have big plans for the quagga in the near future.
We would like to obviously breed up more animals that are truer to the original type. That's the first thing. Nothing would give us greater pleasure than for them to be seen by the public in public spaces.
But before this happens, the quagga will have to conform to strict standards set by South Africa's wildlife authorities. Turnbull's confident this will happen soon. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports, coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Misha Dubinsky, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. Join me on Straight Talk Africa every Wednesday as we discuss topics of special interest to Africans, including politics, economic development, press freedom, health, social issues, and conflict resolution. Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio.